Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome, everybody. This is Ryan Tripp. I'm returned to the New Books Network, the New Books and History channel on said network. I'm here today with Professor David D. Hall. He is Professor Emeritus of American Religious History at Harvard Divinity School. Earlier this year, quite recently actually, he published The Puritans, A Transatlantic History, out by Princeton University Press. Welcome to the show, Professor Hall.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to dive in straight into the questions here. By way of introduction, why did you decide to foreground theology and the politics of religion in your transatlantic study of Puritans? And as sort of an offshoot question, can you address what exactly the Reformed International was?
So I believe in the power of ideas that people, I mean, as an historian, I believe in the power of ideas that people are moved by larger principles. And in religious history, that's often very, very strongly the case. So I wanted to make the book, it aspires to make as clear as possible a small handful of ideas, themes, biblical images that, prompted the movement that in its own time in the 16th century and since became known as Puritanism. By the way, that's a word that these people did not use themselves. It was a negative word. I'll come back to that later on. So when I say theology or repertory of theological ideas, let me shrink that down. So the book does not talk about the divinity of Christ or who God is. It's really a book about the idea and the ideas of the church in the world, what they would call in the 17th century, the visible church, the church as an institution in the world, as of course an instrument of God's purposes, an instrument of Christ's purposes, because it's where redemption occurs. And as we know from our own day, as much as we can learn as historians from the 16th and 17th centuries, the church in the world is always and everywhere caught up in politics, a question of authority. What is the church's authority vis-a-vis the authority of monarchs, the state, the powers that be in a given society? And so in 16th and 17th century England and Scotland and New England, there are a number of players in this field. So my book is about a kind of back and forth reciprocal process between a high, powerful, strong vision of the church as a certain kind of place, a pure place, observing divine, responsive to divine commands, and the politics that unfolds from that idea when it's opposed or runs up against other people's ideas of either the church or of their own authority. And when I talk about these ideas, I foreground one strand of Protestantism. So when the Reformation happened, we think of Martin Luther, 1517, but almost out of the gate, the Protestant movement split it's split into different strands, different trajectories. There's the Lutheran trajectory, which is with us still to this day. There's what was called the Anabaptist, or sometimes the Radical version, which is also with us to this day in the form of Baptists and Mennonites and many others. And then there's the tradition that is often called Calvinism, after John Calvin, that's present in the German Reform, the French Reform, the Swiss Reform, the Presbyterian Church in Scotland. On it goes. And I happen to prefer a different nomenclature, the Reformed International. The word international, and that's the word that I foreground in the book. I don't use the word Calvinism because it's kind of tainted. It suggests that every idea came from Calvin, and that's simply not the case.
So what was the significance of the 16th century Wisterian controversy and Elizabethan settlement to the goals of what you describe as Puritanism and Leiden separatism? And what about the Cartwright-Whitgift debate?
Yeah, these are all topics that I cover in some detail. So just a brief word about the state, the condition of the Church of England in 1558, when Elizabeth I came to the throne. She succeeded a Catholic, her Catholic half-sister. So overnight, the Church of England passed from Catholic to Protestant. And in that new Protestant church, there were lots of what some observers discerned as Catholic elements. There were still Catholic pieces around in churches and how they were built, how they were designed, in worship, and in the dress, the garments that the priest, the minister, was wearing. So Some ministers and bishops and lay people in the Church of England said, hey, look, we have to complete the Reformation of the Church of England. That is, make it fully Protestant. And Elizabeth said, no, I don't think I like that. I think I like this kind of hybrid church. She was very conservative in her own political views. So the flashpoint in the 1560s, once she had settled into control of the church, and by the way, she was the head of the church, so she had the last word, was something that may seem absurd to us, not absurd in the 16th century, what kind of garment the minister wore, and she ordered them all to continue wearing garments that were Catholic garments in the eyes of the leading reformers. So this became known as the Fasterian controversy because a significant group of ministers said, no way, we're not going to wear these garments that descend from Catholicism because they use very, very strong words. These are emblems of the Antichrist. And we have a name for this. Historians have a name for this. It was a name for it in the 16th century. It is nonconformity. I am not going to conform to the official rules of the church. And then the question rises, of course, maybe do you kick these people out, in which case you lose a cadre of seemingly quite good ministers, energetic, engaged ministers or not. So from the seemingly small question of what priests, what ministers should wear, there arose a larger ambition, a larger set of goals for these people who protested where the queen had stopped. I mean, she had just drawn a line. Stop. We're going to stop the progress of reform. They said, no, we have to continue. So what's next on the list? Worship and how the sacraments are observed. Big issue. Whether you kneel to receive the Holy Communion or not. They were against kneeling. That's too Catholic. So they want a very different kind of worship centered on sermons and prayer. Lots of scripture readings. The queen says, no, I like it the way it is. Then there's bishops. And again, for us, you know, who might say, who cares about bishops? But bishops were another legacy from Catholicism, episcopacy, another legacy from Catholicism. And in the Reformed tradition, there are no bishops. Every minister has exactly the same rank. They're just ministers. So they said, let's have a church like that. And then thirdly, and this was what really angered the queen, they said, oh, by the way, the church should have authority to settle its own affairs with doctrine and worship. And we respect the monarchy, and the monarchy is, charged by God to protect us, to save us from heresy and blasphemy, and above all, save us from Catholicism. But the church should be autonomous. And she said, no, I am the head of the church. And a considerable number of people in the church supported her point of view, especially, of course, all the bishops. So this bitter struggle arose in the 1570s, 1580s, back and forth. When I say bitter, it's through publications and it's through demonstrations like nonconformity. So I just want to, Ryan, I'm just going to move to a little another question, if I may, but I'll raise myself. So the question is, we might think of England as a kind of very top-down governed society, and in a formal sense it was. It had a queen and a privy council, nobilities and things of that sort. It is very, very top-down from our point of view. Parliament was not really representative. But it's a very ramshackle system. By ramshackle, I mean that there were 8,500 parishes in the Church of England. And there was no button the Queen could press or any bishop could press to make sure all these were being observed or all these were under their control or being practiced. There's a lot of lay support for the Puritans, a lot of lay support by wealthy people. So the Puritans entrenched themselves at the local level. They entrenched themselves at Cambridge University, and there's no way to get rid of them. In fact, they flourish. The Puritan movement begins to flourish, even though the Queen denied them everything they wanted.
So let's move a little bit to Scotland. How were 1560s measures implemented for Scottish church structure? And if you can address the second book of discipline, that would be great. And when, as well as how, did the Kirk acquire a Presbyterian system of church governance?
So Scotland, the history of the Reformation in Scotland is almost the opposite of the history of the Reformation in England. And it really begins as a coup d'etat, kind of little revolutionary moment in 1559, 1560, when a small group of very, very exceptionally able ministers, John Knox most famously, and then a group of nobility who allied with them, basically pushed aside the head of state, who was a French woman, Mary of Guise, not really very powerful, and then pushed aside her daughter, Mary, Queen of Scots, Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots. And in the 1560s, the Scottish Parliament acknowledged that Scotland was now a Protestant country, endorsed a confession of faith. And so suddenly this fairly small group of ministers and nobility were actually sort of running the country. And they were then able to do away with every Catholic aspect of worship. There is, they have a book of worship that's actually based on one from Geneva that they borrowed from Geneva, where Calvin was head. And ministers are wearing the black scholar's gown, which Presbyterian ministers in this country still wear. The services are focused on preaching, not on the sacraments. And then the question of structure arose. What kind of organization do you want? They do away with bishops. And in 1578, after some confusion and uncertainty about all the details of structure, they established a system of, at the bottom, there are the local church associations called presbyteries. And at the top, there's a countrywide gathering called a general assembly. And this is known as Presbyterianism from a Greek word that then becomes passes over into English, a Presbyterian system. And I should say that the Presbyterians, to call them that, by the 1570s, are also insisting on a version of separation of church and state. We can't use that word in the American sense, but by that I mean simply that they insisted that the church was free to run its own affairs. And this kind of worked for a while, and then it didn't work. And let me just turn to the politics of religion in Scotland. So the King of Scotland was 23 months old, a baby, basically, when he was crowned. This was James VI, Mary Stuart's only child. She had fled to England, where she was eventually beheaded. And so when James VI came of age in the late 1570s, 1580s, he he decided that he wanted to strengthen his kingship, first of all, against the nobility, very, very powerful in Scotland. And he succeeded in doing that. And then against the church, which rebuffed him, said, you know, you can't interfere in our affairs. But he said, look, I'm a Protestant. He was a Protestant. I have the church's best interest in mind. Oh, no, you don't. Oh, no, you don't. You're interfering with us. And James had a point. It's when I was reading the Scottish records, it was quite surprising to come across the strong language to his face that some of the leading ministers used. I mean, they were really quite outspoken to James and basically insulted him. And the more this happened in the 1590s, the less enchanted he became with Presbyterianism, the church system in Scotland. And by that time, he knew that he was going to succeed Elizabeth because she had no children. So he looked south to England. He said, oh, if I could only get across the border, I'll have a better time. And that leads us into the next phase of things.
What were the theological origins, the Augustinianism, and those languages or frameworks for the practical divinity? And why was this practical divinity experientially unusual?
Yeah, so the book, I turn away from structure and politics and spend a lot of time talking about how the Protestantism of these people was lived out in piety and devotion, in what we might call simply conversions. And in many ways, this is the heart of the matter because Puritanism was a powerfully evangelical movement. By that I mean, the ministers who led this movement and the lay people who were heavily involved, they looked around them and they saw all these English people or Scottish people or, God help us, Irish people, because that's also part of the story, who didn't really seem to be Protestants at all, or just barely Protestants. And so the question was, how do you raise the bar? How do you bring people up to a certain level? And their answer was to preach in a certain manner, teach a certain version of the Christian message, their version of the gospel message of salvation, and then to urge lay people very, very strongly, urge them very, very strongly, every sermon, every Sunday, every possible moment, to engage with devotional practices, organize their lives around a series of routines, which and turn them into these kind of very, very strong Protestants. And this is a project that we might say in retrospect was bound to fail. You can't turn everybody into a zealot Christian, but they tried it very, very hard. So Augustine appears in this story in my book because he, in responding to other theologians of his own time, he asserted that God had predestined, that is to say, arranged beforehand at the very moment of creation, who was going to be saved. So this is called the doctrine of election or sometimes the doctrine of predestination. And the Puritans loved Augustine, as did many others, even Catholics. So they were Augustinian in the sense of adopting the point of view that you can't be saved by your own efforts. God has arranged this for you. And then, of course, the figure of Christ enters the story because Christ died on the cross to save us from original sin. So we are all pardoned. And in that sense, we are already well along the path to being saved. But the Puritans, this is what makes the Puritanism so interesting. And it's not the only version of Protestantism or Catholicism that does this. It says to lay people, the ministers say to lay people, well, there's still a lot for you to do. There's still stuff you must do. You must be active. You can't just sit there and say, well, it's all over. It's all taken for granted. I'm saved, or maybe I'm not saved. So, and then they say, so there's things to do, chiefly repent, and then organize your life so you're not misbehaving. But they add another layer to it, and this, Ryan, is what you were referring to, and what I talk about at length in the book, is they say, you know, just going through the motions is, God doesn't care about that. Christ doesn't care about that. He wants you to act from the heart. And by the heart, they don't mean, of course, our little thumping heart. They mean the inner self, the soul of the self. They want you to be truly committed in the sense that your entire self, your emotional self, or as they would say, your affective self, was completely involved. And okay, that's raising the bar pretty high. And the Puritans became very careful scrutinizers of what they called hypocrisy or formalism. If you're just going through the motions, that's formalism or hypocrisy. And very astute and analytical students of what happens in the heart. And so it's a religion that's very, very emotional. And so I tend to that. I tell life stories. I draw from people's diaries about the emotions they were feeling. They weep. They feel sometimes that God isn't with them. And then they're very, very sad, or we might say depressed in our language. And then the Holy Spirit comes and renews their sense of joy and presence. I mean, it's really a very, very emotional form of religion, quite contrary to what we sometimes think Puritanism to be. And that side of their tradition, that side of this practical divinity, as it became known as, has had a long-lasting influence. I mean, it lasted through the 19th century. It still is present in British and American Protestantism and worldwide Protestantism to this day.
So on that note, what were the roles of devotion, self-examination, and justifications of the ministry in this practical divinity? And if you can also just address the role of assurance, particularly in the context of predestination and its significance to those Arminian objections.
Sure. Well, devotion figures in the book because the ideal Christian life, as understood by these ministers and their allies, was not unlike Catholic life in some sense. So in theory, every day you would do a little exercise of self-examination, sort of search yourself for sins that you had not repented or mistakes that you had made that you would then remedy. Every day you would read the scriptures, some passages of scriptures. Every day you would pray. Not every day, but some days you might participate in what today we would call small groups, where you're sharing discussions of the Bible and discussions of your own spiritual history. The essence of it is, don't waste time going to the theater. Don't waste time just hanging out at the tavern. Organize your life around a pattern of devotion. And we can't really say what numbers of people did this, but we know from certain diaries and above all from what was preached that this mattered a great deal. And not every day, but very often, the people who were Puritans did actually do self-examination and repent and bewail their sinful condition. The book takes up, and I could have written an entire chapter about this. In fact, I cut out a lot. It actually eventually got too long. The leading question was, okay, am I a hypocrite? Am I a formalist? Am I not really loved by Jesus? Or am I saved? The great question that the jailer asks in the book of Acts, am I saved? And so what's the evidence of being saved? And on this question, there arose a division of opinion. And that figures strongly in the book, especially when we get to the 17th century, where the divisions became very, very visible and very, very acute and led to all kinds of problems. So the question is, what can I rely on? The key word is justification, which is a technical theological word. It's when Christ imputes his own righteousness to you, and poof, everything is okay. So what are the signs of justification? Well, the most obvious sign would be your personal righteousness or good works. Because the assertion can be made that only someone who was saved could actually do good works and overcome selfishness, corruption, and so forth and so on. Oh, yes, okay, so I'll do lots of good works. But as soon as that position is taken, and people rush out to count up their good works and do more good works, this sounds like formalism. So then there are other ministers who say, wait a minute, we need to bring back in the witness of the Holy Spirit, which is basically invisible, except that it is felt in the heart. To which the answer is, well, can't people fake that? I mean, can't they fake the witness of the Spirit? And is that really reliable? So there's a kind of loop. Yeah, a loop would be a good, I don't use that word in the book, but that would be a good analogy for what happens. You ground the loop. One moment it's the witness of the Spirit. One moment it's what's in your heart. At the moment it's what you do, counting up your doing. And this troubles a lot of historians, a lot of theological historians who feel that the system can either tilt too much toward works or too much toward what's called antinomianism, which is no works at all. So finding the balance is a struggle for lay people. It's a struggle for ministers. And it's especially a struggle in the early 17th century because alternatives within Calvinism were emerging. The most famous of them is called Arminianism, after a Dutch theologian whose name is Jacobus Arminius. And he says, well, God does take account of what you do. In other words, he modifies predestination. And there's some people who say, well, yeah, maybe he does. And plenty of other people say, oh, no way, we can't have that. But nonetheless, continue to evoke works or duties or righteousness as evidence of being justified or evidence of being saved. So again, it's a loop. What's so interesting about this loop is that, may I jump to New England here for a moment, Ryan? Do you mind if I?
Sure.
So to jump ahead to New England, which, or to Massachusetts in particular, which was founded by English Puritans in 1629-1630. Plymouth was founded earlier than 1620 by a tiny group of Puritans who we'll come back to. So the colonists get over here to Massachusetts, and there's all kinds of dynamics that are unfolding. I'm going to mention just two of them. One is they come over. You can imagine coming over that they want the highest standard of purity. You know, just we're here. We're finally out from under the Church of England and all of its various compromises. We're going to have the highest standard of purity. But what is that? What is the highest standard of purity? And Roger Williams says, well, the highest standard of purity is to be very, very scrutinizing of who's going to be members of the church, who's only the really pure should be in. But then that begs the question, who are the really pure? And then he and another man look around and they see that there's a flag being used. It's the king's flag. It's a military flag, really. And it has a Catholic emblem in it, just left over. And he says, we have to cut this out of the flag. We can't possibly have this kind of flag flying in this purified country. And there's a huge controversy that erupts over whether to purify the flag. And it's what the problem with the controversy is that if word got back to England that they were cutting this out, it would anger the king, and they didn't know what would happen if that were the case. And then there's the question of assurance of salvation. And there are people who say, a small group of people who say, we really have to focus on the witness of the Spirit. And then a larger group of people say, oh, no, we can combine that with works and duties. And there is a fierce, fierce struggle that breaks out in 1636-1637. Of course, the majority prevails, and some people are exiled to Rhode Island or go back to England, most famously Anne Hutchinson. Roger Williams is also exiled to Rhode Island. Happily, Rhode Island was there, just a spare plot of land that the Massachusetts didn't control. So so New England, what's fascinating, the dust begins to settle in New England after 1637, so-called antinomians have been pushed out, and Roger Williams has been pushed out, and not very many people in the long run, but some of them pushed out, is that they look around and they say, okay, we've got a pretty good pure church, let's have the government order that everybody attend each Sunday service, whether they are church members or not. So in every town, my book talks a lot about one town in particular, Cambridge, Massachusetts, because of the records that survive. And so everybody is attending, all the children are being catechized, everybody is obliged to pay to contribute to the cost of the minister, but only some can participate in the sacraments, the Lord's Supper, Holy Communion, children be baptized. So there's a name for this system that another historian has used that I appropriate, called parochial congregationalism. So on the one hand, it's a congregational-based church, no synods, no presbyteries, no general assemblies. Everything is local, and churches are not town-based, but gathered. But alongside that model, the colonists add this other layer of everybody attending and all the children being catechized. And so it's one of the lessons of this book is that in New England, as in England and Scotland, also in Ireland, don't look for consistency. Please don't look for consistency. People accepted, they lived out contradictions. They knew of some, they didn't know of others. We see some they didn't see. They saw some maybe we didn't see. So the history of Protestantism in England and Scotland and Ireland and New England in the 16th and 17th centuries is not a history of a kind of a machine unfolding impeccably, absolutely clearly. It's really a story of people doing the best they can under very difficult circumstances, political circumstances in England and Scotland and Ireland, and other kinds of circumstances, just dying by the scores in Massachusetts because of the weather, lack of food, and things of that sort, and struggling in various ways. It's a story of, as I say, quests, searches for purity, searches for an alternative to Catholicism that were met, but also deeply complicated. And I personally find them quite moving to look back upon. I'm not speaking out of any particular bias on my part. I think just intrinsically, the historical record, especially of the Scots and the colonists and some of the English, is a story of well-meaning people trying to do the best by what they understood the Bible to say, and what Christ wanted them to say, what biblical history told them to say, and then what is possible within their own particular historical setting to actually accomplish.
So, on that note, in 16th and 17th century England, why did narratives of disorder and decline emerge? And how did state churches come to enforce social discipline? And what blunted this reformation of manners? And what did Puritan-style reform look like, especially in the context of liberty and divine sovereignty?
Yeah, so one of the features of English, early modern British Protestantism, is actually a biblical theme. Because in the Old Testament, God hands the laws to Moses, and very promptly the people disobey. And again in the Old Testament, there's a good king, and there's a bad king, good prophet, and the people ignore the prophet. And so there's a ongoing alternation between corruption or decline, or what we often refer to as declension, and restoring purity. It's a dialectic. Mostly a story of decline, punctuated by moments of returning to a high level of righteousness. So it's when you come over to Shakespeare's time in England and Scotland at the same time, it's quite astonishing how universal the sense was that these countries, these cultures, these societies were declining. And some of this had actually economic sources. There were a lot more unemployed people. Inflation was rampant. They didn't have the word unemployment, but that's what was happening. They called them the masterless men, masterless women. And then there were places like taverns, which seemed intrinsically sites of disorder. And then there's unlicensed sex, and there were too many children being born out of wedlock. And people weren't respecting marriage, and this is also actually a fact. So all these cries, or you know, people, ministers and kings and privy councils and parliaments, oh, we got to do something about this. And the name for doing something about it is called a reformation of manners. And this is universally subscribed, this idea, this concept. And the idea is to establish a Christian society, a sanctified society, a society that's fully aligned with divine law. Let me just take one example, the Sunday Sabbath. So in England, people were supposed to go to church Sunday mornings and sometimes Sunday afternoons, but then in the evening they were kind of free to do what they wanted to. So a lot of them went to the taverns and did what people do in taverns, or a lot of them played games or danced Saturday, Sunday afternoons, party, because the rest of the week was pretty much spent in labor. And so the question is, or they wandered around the church and didn't sit down and came in and out. And by the way, there were usually trade fairs. The markets were sometimes open on Sundays. And so there's this huge uproar about the Sunday Sabbath and making it more intact, making it more righteous, and suppressing alehouses and suppressing markets, and making sure people turned up in the afternoon. And by the way, this is a stone, to use an analogy, this is a metaphor, this is a stone that gets rolled up the hill decade after decade, year after year. Anglicans, Puritans, you name it, the stone always rolls back down the hill. It's just impossible to get everybody to behave the same way on Sunday Sabbath. There's not enough police around to enforce this rule or this vision. So there's a general perception of decline. You can see it actually in some of Shakespeare's plays. And then, so the Puritans borrow this notion of decline. They reiterate this notion of decline, and they have a very, very strong view of a sanctified society. And they articulate their vision in books and in a handful of towns that they control. They do some remarkable experiments with setting people to work. They were also bothered by illiteracy, and so they want people to be literate so they can read the Bible. You ask about the agenda, the Puritan agenda. So a strong Sunday Sabbath, literacy, work, fairness and justice in the workings of the government. They are very strong advocates of law reform because the law system is very, very arbitrary and favoring the rich. And they don't like that. They're mostly middling kind of people. They don't like that. May I just jump ahead for a moment now to the 1640 period? 1640s period.
Go ahead.
So there's a crisis that occurs. The entire book ultimately hinges on a crisis that occurs in the 1630s. And what happened in the 1630s is that the then king of Britain, king of both England and Scotland and Ireland and Wales, Charles I, turned away completely from the agenda I've been citing, the reformed agenda, the reformed international, the vision of purity that the Puritans were arguing for. He really did not like this group of people. And he regarded them as subversive of the monarchy, as wanting to subvert the monarchy. So he created what we call anti-Puritanism. It was already there, but he enlarged it, publicized it everywhere. The Puritans were against the monarchy, and so he had to suppress them. And as it happened, the Puritans had a reply to this. They were not taking this, you know, without responding. So they said, well, actually, Charles I and his advisors in the church and in civil society were actually secret allies of Catholicism, and their goal was to restore Catholicism to the Church of England and the Church of Scotland. And so these are two powerful things, anti-popery, and anti-Puritanism. But the one that came to prevail was actually anti-Catholicism. Because the king made a huge mistake. He went to Scotland, and he said to the Scots, oh, by the way, I'm going to impose on you the English Book of Worship, just discarding your worship traditions altogether that you've had for 60 or 70 years. I'm going to impose on you the English Book of Worship, which is, from the Puritan point of view, way too Catholic. And there's a famous date in Scottish religious history. It's July 23rd, 1637, when the king, he hears that nothing has happened yet with this new prayer book, and so he tells the Scottish bishops, on this date, July 23rd, you have to start using the prayer book in Edinburgh, the capital city. And when the bishop rises to read from the common prayer, this new prayer book, a woman hurls a stool at him. They sit on stools, not in pews. And other people, women mostly, hurl other things, less savory things at him. And he runs out of the church, and there's a riot. People pursue him, hurling more things, and other bishops run. And this riot prompts an insurgency, a political insurgency led by nobility and senior clergy against the religious policies and the political policies of Charles I. And what's completely unexpected is that these insurgents take over the Scottish government. Charles I's authority evaporates in Scotland in late 1637-38. And then there's some episodes which I'm going to skip. He tries to come with an army to subdue the insurgency. He's unsuccessful. He has to call a parliament. And that parliament in England is just enraged by his policies in England, including his religious policies. And there ensues this astonishing period in English history that's known as the period of the English Revolution, the Puritan Revolution, touched off, as I emphasize very strongly in my book, by the Scottish Revolution, in which the state church is dismantled, the monarchy, actually Charles is eventually executed, 1649, and a man named Oliver Cromwell comes into power as the head of state, a Puritan, actually. So it's a remarkable period of time. Now, remind me of your question. I've overlooked a part of your question.
So, what did Puritan-style reform look like, especially in the context of liberty and divine sovereignty?
Yeah, so, the ongoing issue for the Puritans in terms of reform and a good society was divine law. What does the Bible tell us? And the Old Testament is, of course, full of laws that God gives the children of Israel, the Ten Commandments, but others. And so the Puritans in England and in New England and in Scotland want to observe divine law. And so they want, for example, adultery, which is sex between people who aren't, someone who's married and someone who's not. They want that to be a capital crime. In other words, to be executed for it. On the other hand, when it comes to theft, which was a capital crime in England above a certain amount, they want restitution, which is what the Old Testament prescribes. Strong views of the Sunday Sabbath, strong views on blasphemy, also to be punished by execution. And so actually under the Puritan regime in England, in Scotland, and New England, the law code, this is all as you were asking, all in the name of a sanctified society, you have to have the right code of laws. The liberty comes in because they also believe very, very strongly that Christians are born to liberty. This is to quote St. Paul, born unto liberty. And by that they mean several things, but I'll simplify it to say that lay people should have the right to participate in church government. So there's a lay, I'll restrict that, lay men should have the right to participate in church government, in running congregations or running churches. And this is not a Catholic idea. This is not an Anglican idea. It's a Reformed idea, and especially a Puritan idea. So liberty, which is a very, very confusing word, because it means so many different things, means for the Puritans primarily the liberty to receive the word freely and the liberty to have a role in actually governing the church. And that leads to the form of church government we call today, America, we call it, and in England as well, called Congregationalism, which is a church without any hierarchy of any kind. Every church, every local church, is technically free to do exactly as it wants. And the lay people, now including women, of course, can govern that church. So the 1640s are a fascinating period because the Puritans finally get to try out in England and Scotland some of their more radical ideas. And in New England, where they have a clean slate, there's nobody there to oppose them. They can do so even more fully. But Ryan, I want to just say, I was mentioning contradictions earlier. So if we went through every surviving court record from Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Haven, Plymouth, and we said, well, how many executions for adultery were there? We've got this law. Adultery is a capital crime. The answer is there are about 3 people who are executed. And you're probably smiling at this point because is that the sum total of people who committed adultery? Absolutely not. And in Scotland, it was the same thing. I know of 2 people in Scotland who are executed for adultery. And again, that's just whatever the figures, but we don't really know quantitative for the other side. But so it's as I wrote this elsewhere in another book. It's as though it's you show God that you really care about adultery, blasphemy, but you realize the cost to your own human community of executing people. It disturbs a whole friendship network, family network. It has other problems that come with it. So people can be mildly punished in other ways, sit on a stool, sit in the stocks, something like that for a while, but so these laws, which look to us so incredibly punitive, the one that looks so incredibly punitive is that children at the age of 14 could in principle be executed if they abused their parents. Now, wouldn't we like something like that today? But in any case, not that extreme, but no child, 0 children were ever executed or even brought to trial. So it's, again, we're talking about Puritanism. And, today there's a sense that everybody uses the word rigid or dogmatic or embittered or persecuting, things like that. These are part of the anti-Puritan tradition, which lives on to our present time. The historical record certainly shows some strong principles, some strong visions of what a Christian society would look like. But let me just go back to the liberty thing for a moment. And I want to talk here about Oliver Cromwell. So Oliver Cromwell concluded that God did not want the church to ever persecute anyone. And he really meant everyone. And so he believed in what he called, and we would call, liberty of conscience. There's a spiritual unity that brings together well-meaning people, Christians of all kinds. But that spiritual unity cannot be coupled with the church trying to impose itself. So during his brief period as head of the state of England, 1650-51, depending on the date, until he died in 1658, his government practiced liberty of conscience. It didn't mean that they were perfect. The record is not perfect by a long shot. But he did quietly allow Jews to be readmitted to England and to practice their religion quietly. He looked the other way when he heard about Catholics who were practicing. He looked the other way when he heard about anti-Puritan Anglicans were practicing. He looked the other way when some really heterodox ideas began to surface about the divinity of Christ, like denying the divinity of
She looked the other way. And so Puritanism, again, is a deeply paradoxical thing. On the one hand, we might say, hey, it's always persecuted, or seems to be persecuted. It certainly sets out to eliminate blasphemy and heresy. But then you've got Oliver Cromwell, and you've got John Milton, and you've got lots of other, you've got Roger Williams, you've got lots of other perfectly authentic Puritans who take a different stand. So its legacy to us is, its legacies to us are not one legacy, but several legacies. And you mentioned ahead of time, Ryan, that you wanted me to say a little bit about the epilogue. Is now a good time to turn to the epilogue?
Sure.
So my editor at Princeton, who was pretty tolerant of what I was doing, although a little surprised that the book had become so long, but I turned it in, she said, well, don't just end the story in 1660, which is where I do end it. Tell us what about the afterlife of Puritanism. So the afterlife of Puritanism is actually a very interesting subject that I sadly could only treat in a very short space. So on the one hand, think of the presence in our own culture, our own society in the 19th century, early 20th century, of movements of moral discipline, moral reform, prohibition, a prohibition amendment to the Constitution, strengthening the Sunday Sabbath. There was actually an attempt in the 1870s to add an amendment to the Constitution to protect the Sunday Sabbath. Or, of course, anti-slavery, which some Protestants did not side with, but others did. And before the Civil War, this became a huge issue among Protestants and then in the country as a whole. And on it goes. And I happen to have grown up in this culture. My family was a teetotaling family and a very strongly Sabbatarian family. So I felt the long shadow of the Puritan movement very directly in how I was raised. So that's one way of talking about the long impact of the Puritan movement. And Methodists and Baptists contributed very heavily to that, to those impulses, Presbyterians, Congregationalists to some extent. There's another way of looking at the legacy of Puritanism, and that is to realize that by the 19th century, no one was a Puritan. I mean, the politics of Puritanism had ceased to be relevant for the most part. So people are inventing their version of Puritanism. The way is clear to say, well, the Puritans were this, the Puritans were that, the Pilgrims were this, the Pilgrims were that. So a lot of what I talk about in the epilogue is myths or images or kind of reconstructions of what the Puritans were. And we have a famous example of that in America in Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel, The Scarlet Letter, which sadly is off base in terms of the historical evidence, but has had a tremendous impact on our, what we think of Puritans being. A harsh, grim, hypocritical people. Arthur Miller's The Crucible is a role in this too. And then there are others who see the Puritans as sort of saviors of a fallen country, the country in decline. And I touch on that a little bit, especially in England in the 19th century, where there were people who rose up as prophets and say our country is in decline, England, Scotland is in decline, and could we go back to being a Puritan country? And there are probably still some people in this country today who feel that way. That wasn't my own family tradition. So the epilogue reminds us of something. Reminds us that historians, when they go back to write about the past, they're telling stories. And our goal as historians, our purpose as historians, is to base those stories on what we would think of as evidence or sources, to align them as fully as possible. And that's certainly my goal in this book. That's the first goal, the second goal, the third goal, the last goal of this book is to be faithful, faithful to the words and actions that people actually took in the 16th and 17th centuries to reproduce as clearly, as lucidly as possible what they said, to make sense of them for us. But we also bring to the past our own concerns, our own questions, our own anxieties, our own hopes, our own frustrations. And so inevitably there are values that we have that are maybe slightly different from what the Puritans have or what anybody we study had. We want to make more of them or less of them. And you know, I don't think this is not a book about America in decline, thank God. Whether it is or isn't is irrelevant to this book. It's not a book about some more hopeful future for America, if it were Puritans. I don't say that in the least. I don't think that in the least. I should take that point of view. But it is a book about a tradition, the Puritan tradition, that in the 17th century was rich in resources, rich in spiritual resources that could be still helpful today, rich in political resources in the sense of making so much of participation, fairness, and justice, and equity. So it's the book. The Puritan tradition is over in a formal sense. It's gone, ended in the 17th century in a formal sense. But I hope that the epilogue at least reminds us that there are echoes, residues, possibilities that linger on to the present time. I talked about this in an earlier book, 2011, it's called The Reforming People, even stronger saying it now. So that's covered some ground, and maybe there's some questions still that you have.
Yes, I just have a couple questions. Specifically in the context of New England, which you've already alluded to, who were the Laudians, and how did that program generate the Great Atlantic Migration? And who were the transatlantic saints seeking to advance church membership as a prerequisite for civil governance? And if you can address the congregational way, what do you mean by that?
Sure. Let me start with the third, the congregational way, and I'll work my way back. So the congregational way, so the term congregationalism that you see all around New England and elsewhere, this is a congregational church, congregational, didn't come into being until the 19th century. So in the 17th century, the ism version didn't come into being until much later. And so in the 17th century, the term that was used in England was the congregational way, just the way of doing things. And so what it means is that there's no hierarchy. Every local church is autonomous, do what it wishes, ideally consulting with other churches. Ministers are elected by the congregation. The membership of the congregation is not parish-based, that is to say automatic, but it's not geographical. It's faith-based or spiritual-based. So that's the quick rundown in the congregational way. And it became the dominant system here in New England. It was never more than a minority position. England remains so to this day. Presbyterians had outnumbered them. And then I'll take the first of your questions. The Laudians. So when Charles I came to the throne in 1625, he formed a strong relationship with a bishop in the church named William Laud, L-A-U-D, and Laud became his spiritual advisor. And Laud, who's a deeply admired person by many in the Church of England, elsewhere, Laud had a vision of the Church of England that was to emphasize the sacraments, not preaching, rather than preaching, to emphasize the holiness of the church and make it restore its beauty and some of its Catholic aspects, images of the saints and so forth and so on. And so that program advanced under Charles's leadership, and that's why Charles, as I was talking about some minutes before, wanted to impose an English-style prayer book on the Scots. That was a Laudian gesture. Laud was with him when he made that decision, and may have been involved, but certainly involved in making that decision. So Laudians, or that's just a name for all those who agreed with Laud, Laudians became the strongest under Charles I, they became the strongest party in the Church of England, who were running the Church of England. And then Laud was arrested for treason in 1640, when the Parliament came into being, the new Parliament, and executed in 1645. Charles was executed in 1649. So he became a kind of martyr figure. He is a kind of martyr figure, as is Charles, to this tradition of Anglo-Catholicism, as it's usually known. And when as this was happening in the 1620s and 1630s, as the Laudian Party was taking control of the church, one can imagine the alarm among Puritans in England. Will we still have a place in the church? Will there be any room for us in the church? And so that's when some decided to cross the Atlantic. Not only a small fraction of the Puritans in England crossed the Atlantic to come to New England. And when they came, they began to use the term visible saint, or who could be a church member? That's your second question. And that was to raise the bar for church membership very, very high. To be a visible saint. Of course, the invisible saint is known only to God. That's a mystery that God knows. But to be a visible saint, man, that is to jack up the standards. And the book tells, it's in the book I describe that standard, reactions to that standard, and eventually how that standard was eased, relaxed in the course of the 17th century.
So ultimately, why did Puritans engage in, you know, poetry, fast days, the Germans, over perceived decline? I mean, you alluded to this earlier, but if you can elaborate a little bit, purportedly caused by the quote-unquote rising generation.
Yeah, in New England, it's a fascinating question because they come over and they're excited. My goodness, here we are. We're free. So exciting to be here. And they were excited to be here. Even though the conditions were very tough at the beginning, early going, a lot of people went back, which is not usually known by Americans, gave up on blame. So you're coming over in Cambridge. I'm sitting in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as we're talking. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, the local minister, a very gifted man, Thomas Shepherd, he looks around him and, you know, it's life or death to get fields cleared and corn raised. It's life or death to have cattle, and because these were meat-eating people. They were not living off fish, not used to eating fish. And it's life or death. And he says after a while to the townspeople in his sermons, we have these sermons, he says, you know, you're obsessed with your farms. You're obsessed with the pigs you have. You're obsessed with property. What's happened to your religion? And he uses the word decline, and he says we have to renew our commitment to the divine as coming first. So this is a kind of contradiction. This is a kind of contradiction. I mean, we don't have what the lay people said back to him. We can imagine them sitting there hearing him say this, say, well, how are we going to feed ourselves if we don't get some more land cleared? I mean, it's life or death. And of course we're obsessed with clearing the land and planting orchards, all the things they had to do, amazing list of things they had to do to survive. So then the children come along. There have been a lot of children. And the children have never experienced the tough times of the Puritans in England. It's a classic immigrant experience. Happens again and again and again and again in American history. The immigrant generation, the parents have gone through a lot of difficulties. The children are born here. They're raised, you know, in America. They're different. And the ministers, like not so much Thomas Shepherd, but plenty of others, say, hey, wait a minute, these children are not as zealous as the parents were. The parents sacrificed everything to get over here. What are the children sacrificing? They also are wanting land. They're also very greedy for more land. You know, I want more land. Partly because they're having children themselves and they need lots of land for their children. So this argument about decline, which to Thomas Shepard in the 1630s was straightforward, you know, stop being so obsessed with your pigs, orchard, whatever, turns into a larger complaint about, and the phrase that people use is the rising generation. Why aren't the children as zealous as we were? This happens in the Quaker movement. This happens in the Baptists. I mean, it can be said again and again and again in churches around the world, Christian churches around the world, and no doubt elsewhere. And, you know, you make a sacrifice, you're zealous, and then the children don't have to make the same sacrifice. So that's the heart of the matter, and it leads to, I cite a poet, minister, Michael Wigglesworth, who, absorbing all of this, writes poetry about New England in decline. And one of his most famous poems called The Day of Doom. It's published in 1662. By the way, if you find a copy in your attic, you'll be a very, very wealthy person. Very few copies survive. In fact, none of the first edition. It's a poem about the Day of Judgment. Christ returns. It's sort of like Santa Claus at Christmas, you know. Suddenly there's a bright light in the sky, and you hear sounds, trumpets sounding. Christ is coming back, and the dead are raised, and the living are can rush out of their houses, and Christ is arriving to bring together the saints and send the rest of the people down to hell. And Wigglesworth goes to great detail about all the things that people have done that Christ might not like. It's a judgment poem. It's a wake-up call poem. I mean, the purpose of this is not actually to say you are going to hell or you're not going to be saved. The purpose of the poem is to say, wake up, because be careful, because you might go to hell. And curiously enough, this poem sold like hotcakes in New England. Actually sold in England too. It's a pretty good poem. It's a long poem, The Day of Doom. So declension became a major literary genre, we might say. The Jeremiah, it's sometimes called, major literary genre. People preach it again and again. And then something bad happens, a drought, a storm, a war, whatever. Oh, that's God punishing us for our misbehavior. That's, by the way, not unique to the colonists. It's also a theme in Scotland and England. So that's part of the Jeremiah tradition, the declension theme, and has deep imprints, leaves deep imprints on sermons, and histories, and other things. Let me just go back to the Pilgrims for a moment. So William Bradford, came over with the Mayflower, became governor of the colony, little tiny little colony. He writes a history of kind of marvelous book called Up Plymouth Plantation. And of course, initially there was only one village, Plymouth. And then in the 1630s, 10, 15 years later, the young people of the town are looking for more land. And so they found Scituate and Duxbury and other towns near Plymouth. And for Bradford, this is decline. We no longer have this wonderful fellowship and everybody sacrificing for the good of the whole. And that becomes, of course, a theme throughout American history, that people are greedy and fill in the X, capitalism and everything. People are not thinking of the good of the whole anymore. We owe that theme to, first of all, the Old Testament, and then we owe it to the Puritans.
So we've already discussed your epilogue. I wanted to address a specific component of it. You argue, why was the real struggle among those descended from the Puritans in turn derived from 19th century conflicts between Congregationalists and Unitarians? Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, here in New England, as of 1800, there were only Congregational churches with a few Episcopal and a few Baptists, a few Quakers. Lots and lots. Every town had a congregation. But the sands were shifting, the sands of doctrine were shifting. And so that, for example, the doctrine of original sin was no longer making sense to some people. And once that doctrine goes, a lot of other things go, like needing Christ's sacrifice on the cross to redeem us from original sin. And so that led to the rise within Congregationalism of people who disagreed theologically with others. And the name that these people acquired was the name Unitarian, because they denied the doctrine of the Trinity, God, Christ, the Holy Spirit, just God. And Jesus was a human or superhuman or divinely sent human, but not equivalent to God. So you can't really have, it's like, you know, oil and water. You can't have both of these in the same bottle at the same time. And so there's schisms, schisms after schism after schism after schism after schism. So here in Cambridge, we have two first churches. One is Unitarian, one is Congregational. But the Congregationalists got kicked out of the original first church and walked around the corner and got another first church called a Congregational Church. So then what I talk about in the book is in the epilogue is how each side tries to validate its position. It's either staying with Orthodoxy or leaving Orthodoxy by turning to the Puritan past. And the Unitarians, I should say that both sides were a little bit troubled by what the past held. Neither side could say yippee for everything in the past. Take just for example the Salem witch hunt, kind of an ugly thing to have on their record. And so, but the Unitarians were very very aggressive in repudiating a lot of the Puritan past, and accused the Congregationalists of, for example, condemning children to die because God was not going to save them, or accuse them of being incapable of true moral action, and lots of other things, and cited the witch hunts, cited Jonathan Edwards, 18th century minister in particular, as evidence of just how bad the theology of the Congregationalists was. And so the struggle broke out for the possession of the past, and I'm sitting in a Unitarian founded divinity school, so one could say that the Unitarians won that issue, that schism, but it's a lot more complicated than that. So that's why they appear in the book, and they play a very distinct role in what I'm going to refer to as myth-making about the 17th century. They were not always faithful to the sources.
So I know I have one final question. I know you're retired. Is there anything new you're working on, any projects you're involved in that you can disclose?
Well, so doing this, I'll say two things. One, just from a strictly human point of view, doing this book, which is 500 page book, was tiring, and I didn't. The last day with the proofs was July 13th, 2019, and I have been having something that's rare in my life—a kind of little holiday from working on scholarship or anything major. I've had some minor things I had to write that agreed to write. So, but you know, I'll answer this in a different way. My mentor at Yale, where I did my graduate work, would say to us, no matter what work has been done on a question or a topic or an aspect of the past, we never know everything. We never have exhausted it. So one of these days, some light bulb is going to go on, and I will sense, I will feel, I'll have this kind of rush that there's something new for me to work on, but I don't yet.
Thank you for being on the show today, Professor Hall.
Thank you for having me.
So the book is The Puritans, A Transatlantic History, published earlier this year by Princeton University Press. On behalf of Professor Hall, This is Ryan Tripp. This has been a production of the New Books Network, the New Books in History channel. As always, please tune in next time.